You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Mission log, stardate 8390. We're in the third month of our Vulcan exile, and it was Dr. McCoy with a fine sense of historical irony who decided on a name for our captured Klingon vessel. And like those mutineers of 500 years ago, we too have a hard choice to make.
Stardate 1986. How on earth can we save the future? The catastrophe in the future can only be averted by a journey into Earth's past. The movie is Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home. This is the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast.
Hello, podcast fans, and welcome to this very special edition of the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast, or possibly the Silver Screen podcast, depending where you're watching it. As has become the norm, this is like the third time we've done this. When we do a series of the Hit or Miss Star Trek, we always end by reviewing a movie which relates to the theme in question. And this particular series, we've been doing time travel, so we naturally thought we'd end with a review of Star Trek, the one with the... No! My apologies. That's better. Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, not the one with the whales. So yeah, we're going to be reviewing that. That's what it's officially called, yeah. So we're going to be reviewing that. And as I said, as we have been doing, it will go up a couple of days early on the Silver Screen podcast channel, but it will be available as an extended version on the Trek channel as usual to end this third series, which, as I said, is time travel related. We did sort of see on a previous episode we were going to be joined by the same crew that we had for the top 10 Trek films. Unfortunately, Adrienne wasn't able to make it at the last minute, which is terrible, but let's be honest, it's in keeping with the way things have been going for this series with our guests and our look. So it seems oddly fitting in a way, but no, it was a genuinely legit reason she had to work. And she has, I did say we still will... you know, I've got a couple of notes and we'll still give her favourite character moment line in conclusion and, you know, put her score into the overall score so that it's counted because it's not her fault, really. So, but we are here as just a threesome. I am your host. Well, one of your hosts, Mike. I'm joined, as always, by our second host, DK.
Greetings.
And we are joined once again by, from the top 10 Star Trek films and an Encounter at Farpoint episode and various bits, my good friend, Stephen Brown. Welcome, Brownie.
Hello there. Hello.
Hello, old man. How are you doing?
Not bad at all. Happy to be here.
I know you've been out LARPing for most of the weekend, so yes, you have fun.
You're touch tired. Touch tired.
A touch?
Obviously I wouldn't because I was a bad guy, so, you know. we maybe, you know. Ruin a few character moments for people, but you know, that's what monsters do.
But yeah, so the three of us are here to review, as I said, Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home. We've all watched it, and I have already annoyed these two by bragging about how good it looks in 4K. That's the only time I'll mention it in the official review, but yes, it does, just so everyone knows. As I say, we will, we're not going to have the usual sections that we have on Hit or Miss Star Trek, because as when we always do, a movie, it will break down differently, and we'll do it the way that we do our film reviews over on Silver Screen. If you're not following that, please do. I'll put a link in the description. So we will basically do a behind-the-scenes little bit of sort of background information, then jump into our review, which will break down into just random sections like writing, direction, acting. It's free-form conversation, so it doesn't really have to have any sort of chronological order. We'll just sort of go where the conversation will hopefully take us. And then, as I already mentioned, we'll end with our favourite character moment and line, conclusion and score. And I do have a little bit of feedback from the audience on this film, which, as you would imagine, is universally hated. It's really not. So, without any further ado, then I'm going to throw over to my other host, DK. DK, you're going to take us into the behind-the-scenes section, and would you like some background music if you are?
Oh, why not? Go for it.
Okay, let's see. What shall we pick for you for it?
Something sleazy.
I like the sound of Interspace. Let's go. There we are. How's that?
That's suitably sleazy. I can deal with that. Right. Obviously, you know, it's been out quite a while, and obviously the making of is well known to quite a lot of people. So if you've got anything else, feel free to join in. But I'm going to start. Not only was the movie originally intended to be a sequel to 84's Search and Spot and an end to the trilogy that began with Wrath of Khan, but also as a vehicle for the then very much in demand Eddie Murphy. Murphy was supposedly, I'm putting that in quotation marks, an avid Trekkie and wanted to join the franchise. Screenwriters Peter Crikes and Steve Mearson put together a script featuring Murphy as an English teacher with an obsession for the UFO phenomenon. A sequence of this script would see the bird of prey decloaking above a football field during the Super Bowl, with everyone, apart from Murphy's character, believing it to be part of the halftime show. Now, thankfully, it never came to pass, as Murphy was dissatisfied with the script and instead dropped out to make Paramount's other feature at the time, The Golden Child, leaving the present-day protagonist role to be filled by Catherine Hicks.
Indeed. I did read that he was going to also be the Plexicorp scene. He would have been the guy that they kind of give that formula to. So, yeah.
I'm not quite sure how that would have tallied, to be honest. But yeah.
Exactly, but yeah. It would have probably ended up a lot like Superman 3, where they just shoehorned Richard Pryor in for terrible comedy.
Oh, actually, I could get on board with something like that. You know what I think of Superman 3.
You would.
Now, Shatner was apparently reluctant to return to the role of Kirk after Trek 3, which led to producer Harv Bennett originally floating the idea of a prequel set during the crew's Academy days.
Yeah.
But Shatner was persuaded to join the movie, not only with a substantial pay rise, but on the proviso that he himself would get to direct the next movie out of, should this one do well. Fortunately, this one did do well. Not so fortunate with the movie that resulted from this contract.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Though looking back, one wonders if Shatner really would have gone through with not appearing, or was he testing the waters to see how his demands would have been met after Nimoy acquired the director's chair for Trek 3?
Yeah, I think that's probably the case, to be honest.
Yeah. Now, while attempting to find the nuclear vessels, Chekhov and Uhura find themselves stood on the street in San Francisco and asking random passers-by for help after getting no aid from the police. Surprise. The only civilian to step in and at least try to help them was played by extra Leila Seracolo. Seracolo was not an actor and was only offered to be an extra in the scene to earn some money to retrieve her car. After waking that morning, she found that her car had been impounded due to the production's filming. To get around this, she approached the crew, was hired as an extra, and then ad-libbed a line, which was surprisingly kept in the final cut. It earned her the credit and saw her inducted into the Screen Actors Guild, as well as earning her hopefully some money to get a car back from being impounded.
Yeah, I heard that story. I love that story as well.
Yeah.
She wasn't supposed to say anything and basically just kept on throwing in a line so that she'd have to be inducted into SAG and get paid. So,
I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I think it was either Nimoy or Bennett that actually just liked the line in the end and were like, just keep it.
Yeah. Now, there was a scene where Sulu meets his great-grandfather as a boy on the streets of San Francisco. However, this was cut by Harv Bennett, due to the insufficient acting ability of the boy playing Sulu's ancestor. Apparently, the boy's mother was on set and unsettled him to the point where his performance suffered. The scene does remain in the Voitron novelization, however, for those eager to see what transpired.
Yeah, it's a shame because Sulu gets nothing to do in the film as a result.
No. Now, art director Nilo Roddis, I mean, this is a well-known one, but he approached robotics expert Walt Conti to come up with a solution to provide whale footage after attempting to film the creatures in real life offered no tangible results. Conti's replacement whale effects were so good that activists, as well as the US fishing authorities, criticised the production for endangering the whales as they were all convinced the subjects were real.
Mm-hmm. I knew that too.
Yeah, exactly. Most of this stuff is, you know, kind of common knowledge.
Yeah. Now, there is one shot of actual whales, but you can blatantly tell because it's just obvious stock footage when they're freed, and it just cuts to a scene of the like whales in the distance in the sea, and it's like, yeah, this might as well have Getty Images stamped across it.
Yeah, shut the stock. Right, according to Nimoy on the Blu-ray commentary, the bus scene where Kirk Fetter plays an antagonistic punk was inspired by real-life events. Nimoy was walking down the street in New York when a punk came out of a nearby store in front of him with his boombox. That's some kind of stereo for the kids listening, which is probably ironic, because the term stereo is probably a dated term at this point. I'm that old. Anyway, the
punk like a really out... big MP3 player.
Yes.
What's an MP3 player?
It's like a really big phone.
Physical streaming. Anyway, the punk coming out of the store was disturbing everyone around and annoyed Nimoy. Thought to himself, if I really was Spock, I'd pinch his head off. So, you know, I think we can all agree that the scene as Bill not only satisfied Nimoy's urge, but any of us who've been stuck on public transport with a self-centered asshole.
Definitely. And, you know, I don't know if you've done this already, but I, over the years, I've had a bit of a deep dive into Kirk Thatcher, who plays the punk on the bus. So I can give you quite a lot of information about him, if you like.
Go for it.
Yeah. I don't know if you know this, but he's actually still a working actor and producer. He's one of the main people who currently works on Muppets. So
I recognize him in Werewolf by Night.
He was an actor in Werewolf by Night with a fantastic Scottish accent. He briefly reprised the role of Punk on Bus for Picard Season 2, which, again, we're not going to get into the temporal dynamics of how that doesn't make sense. Never mind. He also, I think I remember seeing somewhere that he worked on Farscape on the kind of Muppet puppet things that were part of that. So,
yeah.
Just incredible. The guy's sort of, you would not expect that to be the same dude, but yep, it's him. And he's quite active on social media if you happen to find him.
Oh, I've not noticed him on social media. I'll have to have a look for him.
Liked me a few times, on the old site.
All right. Okay. So, the scene at Plexicorp and then Scotty attempts to speak to the computer was originally supposed to feature Commodore Amiga. For the benefit of those not as old as Mike and me, the Amiga was a popular home computer at the time. However, in yet another marketing triumph that seems to be the norm for movie productions we've discussed on the Silver Screen podcast, Commodore denied the request, wanting nothing to do with the production. Instead, the crew had to settle and make do with an Apple Mac. Now, Commodore USA eventually shut down in 2012, whereas no one really knows what became of Apple, which is weird.
They're making portable stereos.
All right. Small boomboxes. Right, uh-huh. And speaking of Plexicorp, we've mentioned it before on the Silver Screen podcast during the Jurassic World review, but within about 3 years of Trek 4's release, there was indeed a formula created for transparent aluminum.
Aluminium, not Americans.
Hey, I'm pandering here. Pack it in. Now, synthetic white sapphire, as it is also known, has existed since the early 1900s, but never manufactured as large glass-like sheets until the formula for the... aluminium oxynitride was assembled not long after Voyage Home's debut. And finally, this is the only time during the original Q's tenure that Kirk says a variation on the line Scotty Union.
Yeah, I did. I took a note of that because I was like, that's a rarity, but Yeah. By the way, apologies if anyone's having to put up with the audio distortions from DK. It seems to be especially awkward every time you're talking today, the old machine gun sound. But hopefully people understood that.
I am trying to rectify this, people. Don't worry.
Cool, cool, cool. So, yeah, was that everything you had for the behind-the-scenes stuff?
It is, yeah.
Awesome. Lord, I'm going to wait for it to stop. Anyway, yeah, I just wanted to add that obviously the film is dedicated to the memory of the people, the lives that were lost on the Challenger in the well-known shuttle disaster not long before the film came out. So also, you know, obviously extend our condolences for that. We mentioned it already because I think it came up during our first Man review on the Silver Screen podcast. Yeah. Still tragic and still horrible, but it is nice that they get a dedication, you know, that's quite sweet at the start of this movie. I also have a ton of behind the scenes as a sort of knowledge about this film because, and again, I've mentioned this before, I used to have the video VHS set of the first six Star Trek movies. And for some reason, Voyage Home, even in the days before like DVD, you know, extra features and stuff, had like a half hour making of and tons of like a Leonard Nimoy introduction and bits and pieces like that. So the only thing I can remember is that Leonard Nimoy was apparently incredibly proud that the film contains no violence, which as soon as he said that, I was like, okay, you're not counting the Vulcan nerve pinch then. All right, fair enough. But yeah, he was very proud of the kind of environmental message of the movie. And there's some great behind the scenes footage I think you can still find on YouTube where they're filming in just basically massive water tanks on the Paramount lot for the final scene when they're coming out of the Klingon Bird of Prey. And it is hilarious because they are just doing a terrible job of staying upright in the water. So do hunt that out just to find if you get a chance. Yeah, awesome. I will end the music then in that case because I don't have anything else. Stephen, did you happen to know anything about the making of Voyage Home that you wanted to share with anyone?
It has whales in.
It has whales in.
It has whales in it, yeah.
It has fake whales in it. They're not real whales, despite what people thought.
Apart from the pictures of the whales that you mentioned.
Apart from the stock footage at the end, yeah. Exactly. But now they are very realistic animatronic whales and stuff. So, yeah, people make them.
Definitely, yeah. I figured there were the certain shots, though, they were very perfectly in frame.
Yeah. Well, it would be very difficult to get them to behave and get them to just sit there while Leonard Nimoy's trying to, you know, invasively mind meld with them and stuff, I guess. But fair enough. I'll jump straight into the first section, which is all about the writing and the plot and little bits and pieces. So the first note that I've got here is this is the first appearance of a female black captain in the Star Trek franchise, something which a lot of angry nerds were very keen to point out as soon as Sonequa Martin-Green did an interview with Whoopi Goldberg and said that she was the first black captain. I think she may have meant in the main series, guys. Calm down. But yeah, I just thought it was worth making a note of that. It's played by Madge Sinclair, who you may have seen, I think, in what's it called, Coming to America. And captains the USS Saratoga, which is a Miranda-class ship. All of the sorry ship haters and people that don't know about ship classes, we are here for them. I'm not sure how we feel about this, that like it's only, what, three movies since the motion picture, and yet we already have another deadly probe heading for Earth, like unknown intentions and stuff. I was like, was that the best plot you could have come up with? Yeah, I'll let you off, but still.
Yes. Oh, I don't know. The probe itself, for a bad guy, it seemed a bit less than threatening, really. Certainly as a kid, rewatching it, I sort of get it. But yeah, when I was a kid, it was like, it's just a big tube.
Yeah, I do get more now because I don't think it's supposed to necessarily be a threat. And they do kind of, they half explain that by saying it's probably just, you know, putting out a hailing thing for whales to ask, like, how's things going? And when it's not getting a reply, it's like, have you killed all the whales? So it gets angry at you. But yeah, I don't mind the design. It looks very weirdly just nothing, just smooth blackness and a weird little brain ball thing or whatever.
Yeah. Cool singing.
I will say, though, looks good in 4K. Just saying.
Oh. Yeah.
It took me a long time to realize. I don't know if it was just because I was watching it on video when I was younger or on TV, but it took me ages to realize that at the end it kind of tips upright, like it goes from horizontal to vertical when it sucks in the little whatever the receiving ball thing is. I was like, it never occurred to me that's what that thing's doing there. But okay. what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, I do have another little bit. This is kind of behind the scenes-ish, but if you're wondering why they quickly get rid of Savick at the start of the movie, there was a dropped plot, which I don't know if it's even on deleted scenes or anything, that Savick was pregnant with Spock's child after the, let's say, Pon Farr moment they had in Star Trek III when he was going back through puberty and growing up again after his death. I think they probably wisely decided it wasn't great to have Spock just go, yeah, just look after it, I'll never see the child again. And
I think that's why they didn't want Spock to be seen as just like an absent father kind of
thing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's not actually a surviving moment, but it is kind of weird that they just ditch Savick on Vulcan for no apparent reason. So, oh well. And she's still credited as well, which I feel really bad when you're watching the credits and it's like, and, you know, special guest Robin Curtis as Savick. I was like, really? She has like one line, if that. Anyway. I've just got a ton of lines, so apologies if I'm just hitting them as I go without wanting to tread on my favourite and hopefully nobody else's. But one of the great lines from the intro here is definitely when Kirk asks Scotty if he can be ready, and Scotty responds with, damage control is easy, reading Klingon, that's hard. And can we get the cloaking device working? Yes, I just wish we could cloak the stench. Very good lines. One of my favorite scenes is early on in the film when it's between Spock and Amanda, which, again, great that they managed to get Jane Wyatt back to play Amanda, because she's very good in this one scene. And I love that it's kind of, it's Spock doing like the super intelligent test thing and then getting stumped by how do you feel? And obviously Amanda explaining, well, you're half human. The computer has to take that into account. So it's a legitimate question. And the callback to that is what really makes it at the very end. He says, yes, tell mother, I feel fine. I just really love that moment. So what about you guys? You similar thoughts on that scene?
Yeah, it is a nice little callback.
Yeah.
Awesome. It also, I didn't notice this until this time around, but it's also the first reference to T-Planner Hath, who's one of the like founders of Vulcan Society, because I knew that was the name of the ship that made First Contact, but didn't realize that's where it came from. And this time around, being a big geek, I was like, oh, okay. I do like as well that they did take a moment for Savick to kind of stop and tell Kirk about David, as somebody who, as you know, was very emotionally affected by that in Star Trek III. So, you know, telling him that he went out a hero and everything, I think was a nice moment.
Yeah. I didn't get much more, but, you know, with the amount that they did try and fit in this, it's...
Yeah, that's the thing. I did write, like, I appreciate that they took that moment because it's the sort of thing you would imagine would be the first thing to get cut and to lose. So I appreciate that they kept it in, even though, like I say, it's kind of lip service, but at least it's there.
Yeah.
Awesome. Again, I've mentioned this in passing to, I think it was you, Steve, when you were messaging back and forth, talking of favorite lines, when McCoy's sort of debating with Spock about what was it like to die. Spock tells him he would need a shared frame of reference, and McCoy just says, you're telling me I have to die to understand your thoughts on death? And then Spock just kind of turns away and says, oh, excuse me, Doctor, I'm receiving a number of distress calls. And McCoy just, with beautiful sort of sarcasm, just goes, I don't doubt it. The Spock-McCoy relationship I absolutely love in this film. I think it's really well played. It doesn't come off like either one of them is particularly nasty. It's just kind of good banter back and forth. Again, another great line I love. For some reason, I've always remembered when McCoy kind of says, oh, does the probe just want to say hi there to the people of the Earth? And it's Spock that says, well, there's other forms of life on Earth. Only human arrogance would assume the message was meant just for man. So do appreciate that thing. And yeah, I appreciate it. So I'll ask for you guys' thoughts on this. Do you guys appreciate the way that they tied in the kind of save the whales environmental message? Because I feel like it could have been preachy, and yet it doesn't come off like that. It kind of makes perfect sense with the sci-fi-ness of the story.
No, yeah. it's not on the nose at all. I mean, you know, they do get the message across, but it's not rubbed in your face, as it were. And I think that's to the movie's benefit, because a lot of people could have come out of that saying, oh, as they were preaching. But I think they did a good job incorporating into the story. Or, well, you know, incorporating the story around the message, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. What about you, Stephen?
Definitely so. And there's a lot of criticism these days about that sort of thing, where they seem to be forcing that that's actually the point of the entire movie. And yeah, it's there. They're the conservation element, but with that sci-fi twist, and I think they did it really well.
Yeah, I agree. I do wonder if this film was released today, if it would just be decried by right-wing people as that film's just way too woke, telling us all to save the whales and stuff. But it's beloved somehow anyway, so let's not complain. Yeah, it was nice that they used the slingshot technique callback from the original series as well for the time travel. And it looks pretty good in this film, I will say, particularly the scene of when they start time traveling and they have that really trippy sequence of like their heads forming is like a weird shape and lights flashing at you. And I don't know whose idea that was or why, but it always kind of stuck in the memory and was like, whoa, this is so trippy. And again, it took me until this time to realize that there's dialogue in that scene from the end of the film because it's time travel. So
yeah.
Oh man. Trippy. Very trippy. What about you, Stephen? Do you remember that scene? What did you think about it?
Yeah, the graphics and stuff, I suppose that day and age was quite a thing, really, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, the fact that we're going at warp 9.9 towards the sun was a bit interesting, but yeah.
Well, again, they did that in original series. They explained that's how they do the time travel. I'm sure it's not scientifically accurate, but yeah, head towards the sun and break away and hope it slingshots you back in time instead of dying.
How did they find it?
It was during the episode, I can actually answer this, it was during the Naked Time because they were heading towards the sun and they had to do a cold restart of the warp engines or something when everyone was like drunk off of that virus. So it was genuinely by accident at the end of that episode that they just traveled back in time 3 days or something stupid. And we're like, oh, we'll use that. TOS, man, it was a different time in the 60s.
treated it as a threat and it's, calling back to earlier episodes this season and not as we'll just pop back in time, do a routine.
Yeah, they actually made an effort. It wasn't just a question of, and we traveled back in time. No problem whatsoever, you know? So, yeah. I do like as well that the film's very good at like setting up the stakes and things so that as soon as they arrive, the dilithium crystals have been drained and they mention, they can use... was it nuclear fission or whatever, which again is a little bit of a on-the-nose kind of oof, which again, we kind of talked about DK Journal Little Green Men review when they're kind of making a comment on, can you believe they have nuclear power at this particular time? But yeah. And obviously that gives you a chance to have that nice moment when they see the ship and give it the old, Admiral, and it's the Enterprise, which I appreciated, but... again, I should have probably referenced this in the behind-the-scenes stuff, but it wasn't actually the USS Enterprise, if anybody was curious.
It wasn't, no.
Yeah, because that wouldn't have been the same type of ship. It was actually the USS Ranger, and you can kind of tell, because if you look very closely, some people are still wearing USS Ranger caps in the background of some scenes. So, oops. what was that? Oh, yeah, and fun fact, this is the first of the notes that I got from Adrienne. She was actually stationed at the Naval Air Station in Alameda from 1994 to 1996. So,
oh, wow.
Adrienne, I really want to know what that was like if you aren't, held to top secret secrecy and if the Enterprise or the Ranger happened to have been there at the time. So, yeah. I think the humor in this film, again, should be ridiculous, but it really works. So even the thing with, like, the garbage men, let's call them, to pander to the Americans, seeing the, like, cloaked ship landing and just, did you see that? No, neither did you. Let's just go. even Kirk's like, everybody remember where we parked and double dumbass on you and break up, you look like a cadet review. It's all just, yeah, that's when you know what kind of film it's going to be, which I think relates to what you were saying, Stephen, like the threat can't seem too scary or terrifying because it's the tone of the film is quite light and playful. So
yeah, definitely.
Awesome. What do we think about the scene? This really, again, this is only going to bug me because I'm such a nerd, but the scene when Kirk sells the glasses to the guy for money, the antique shop or whatever, and I think it's Spock that says, weren't they a gift from McCoy? And Kirk says, that's the beauty, they will be again. And I'm like, it doesn't work that way. It's not like you're going to go back into the future and they'll suddenly reappear. Surely, right? Like, it's one of those things that baffles my brain the more I think about it. Because I'm like,
John Hodgson, you've been coming.
You what?
Joel Hodgson gif incoming.
It's just a show. I should really just relax. I know, but these kind of things keep me up at night because I'm a nerd. The other time travel stuff makes such perfect sense to me, and yet that one is just like, what are you on about, Kirk? Anyway.
It'd be nice if they actually showed the bastards again in Star Trek V.
Yeah, well, again, you shouldn't have them. Anyway, there's so many cool little bits of humor that I don't notice on first watch that aren't, like, you know, blatantly obvious lines and stuff as well. So the scene when it's like, we need to work out where we're going, how do we figure it out and everything. And they stood right in front of, like, the world's biggest Yellow Pages advert, like the entire side of a building.
Yeah.
Ah, there we go. And Spock's moment of, like, getting on the bus with this amount of, like, you know, huge amount of notes and just saying, wow, what does it mean? Exact change. Awesome. Obviously, we know people have been taking the mick for years out of the way that Walter Koenig as Chekhov asks for nuclear vessels and none finer than Futurama when they did their Star Trek episode, if anyone has seen that and remembers it. I just love that. When Fry asks him to say his sentence, something about, like, oh, we woke up and we had these bodies. Now say it in Russian. When we woke up, we had these bodies. Oh, now say nuclear vessels. No. What did you guys think about the running joke of the colourful metaphors being like an excuse to get away with swearing?
And... yeah, it was a thing that played on, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, context obviously was off a lot of things, which was there, the play.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? They play the fish out of water thing really well by them just not really getting it. And a lot of the sort of mixed up swearing and stuff is a perfect example of that. And but again, something that took me a few watches to realize is when Kirk thinks he's an expert in this and he's like, oh, you can find these things in all the literature of the period. Then names like just random authors that I've never heard of. And Spock just sarcastically goes, ah, the giants. Pretty funny. Again, I appreciate that the economical nature of introducing Gillian as a character by having her, like, literally introduce herself, because that's her job. So she's like, I work at this whale institute and these are my whales, and it gets all of that crap out of the way. I did really sort of, the most disturbing scenes in the film, I think, are when they show the scenes of the whaling on the like video monitor thing that she's showing, because oof, that's graphic. Like, more so than you would expect, necessarily. And again, this is a line that would get absolutely just lambasted today, but Spock saying to hunt a species to extinction is not logical, and Gillian's reply, whoever said the human race was logical. So, I have to ask you guys about this. What did you make of it the first time you saw that Spock was, like, in the tank, mind-melding with the whale and the kind of the comedy? Maybe she's talking to that man. Chicken.
I loved it. I loved that scene.
Unexpected, definitely.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. Awesome. Yeah, George and Gracie are great. As I said, they're basically animatronics, but very convincing. But then you get into the scene where I think Kirk, Spock, and... what's her name, Gillian, are in the car having their discussion. And again, it's just hilarious misunderstanding of various bits and pieces. So, like, Spock saying Gracie's pregnant, leading to the, you know, hit the brake moment. And I think you've mentioned this, DK, the way that they have the thing about, do you like Italian? No, yes, no, yes, no.
Yes.
I love Italian. And so do you.
Yes.
And even the line about, I think he had a little too much LDS in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
A line which has inspired the unofficial abbreviation for Star Trek Lower Decks, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The people that make the show are adamant that they refer to it with the shorthand LDS. Officially, I think it's LD, but they're like, yeah, it's LDS, and it's a reference to Star Trek 4. So, yeah.
Nice.
Again, I mentioned McCoy, I think, is good with Spock, but also in the scenes with Scotty. So in the Plexicorp bit, when he's taking it way too far, and McCoy's like, don't bury yourself in the pot. And he's like, where could my assistant come and join us? Awesome. Another great line, sure you won't change your mind, is there something wrong with the one I have?
Yeah.
And again, I've mentioned it already, but the way the film sets up stakes is really good. So during the dinner scene, when they mention they're on a clock, because if the baby's born in captivity, odds are it won't survive, and they're being shipped off at noon tomorrow. You know, so it gives you that. And then Spock, the scene with Spock immediately afterwards is like, we're talking about all life on Earth, you know, if we don't get it sorted. So, yeah.
There's an interesting little scene in the novelization. I don't know if you've read the novelization. After that, where Gillian's watching Kirk try and eat a slice of pizza, and he's eating it from the crust inwards because they don't have pizza in the future.
I refuse to believe they don't have pizza in the 23rd century.
It's the one thing that puts me off, to be frank.
Yeah, I'm not having that. They definitely have pizza. Okay, I have to ask about this bit, so I'm going to throw it across to you guys. What do you make of the whole thing about the capture and interrogation of Chekhov, and the rather unfortunate use of the R word perhaps during it as well?
Yeah, you would not be able to use that term these days, thank goodness.
I like the way that it's played for the humour again, though, even though, again, it could be serious. So Chekhov not quite getting it, and you're done, mister. I am. Can I go now? And again, DK, you'll appreciate this. I was reading that, you know how there's the funny scene where Chekhov tries to fire the phaser and it's not working because of the radiation or whatever, and he just throws the phaser at them? I read that supposedly that phaser was picked up eventually by Gary Seven and Roberta Lincoln in one of the Khan novels that Rick Everson was trying to sell us on. So it's like a whole... Yeah, there's a whole thing about them retrieving this phaser from an aircraft carrier that shouldn't be there. And I'm like, oh, man, I really have to read these books.
I've just downloaded the first documentary on Kindle, so I'm going to give that a go.
Yeah, I did the same because it was 99p on the Play Store, so I downloaded the first one as well. Definitely going to give it a go and get back to Rick and tell him what we think of it. So. I love the scene where it's a bit of a twist that they send the whales away early, so Gillian, even though she kind of seemed... really like, oh, I don't believe any of this, ends up trying to find Kirk and then just runs into the cloaked bird of prey and sees the like Sulu lowering the water tank to nowhere and whatnot. Yeah. It's just so good. And it's really good effects when you think like it's got to be difficult to pull off. I mean, maybe not, because it is just, I guess, like a light and you just, but still, it looks really cool when they're lowering it into an invisible thing, you know? Yeah, I don't know if you guys thought the same about the effects. I thought what there was, there's not much here in this film, but what there is, I think, really works, you know? Even, like, the flattening of the landing gear into the grass that you don't see anything except the way it just flattens. That's a really cool effect. Probably simple, but it works.
Interesting how they do that, actually. Perhaps it mirrors the grass around it.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know, actually. That's a good point. No, again, I like that every character gets a through journey, so I do kind of appreciate that they take the time to say that they have to stop and help Chekhov and ask Spock, is that the logical thing to do? And he responds, no, but it is the human thing to do. And again, throwing it to you guys, how good is the scene of just when they have to go into the hospital and McCoy is just exasperated and grows a woman a new kidney and he's just disgusted at the kind of barbaric practices and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah,
such a good scene.
What is this, the Dark Ages?
At the very end, which is, how's the patient? Oh, I think he'll pull through. You went in with a she. One little mistake. Oh, cool. And McCoy giving this, like, super complicated sounding thing. And like, what did you say she has? Cramps. Yeah, awesome. Again, to, you know, the faith in Spock about you have to take your best guess. He has more faith in your guesses than most people's facts. And the exciting race against the whaling ship at the end is cool. The heroic dive to rescue the trapped whales in the Bird of Prey is the last minute kind of, problem. I love that the probe is left a bit mysterious. It's not really all that explained. It just kind of packs up and buggers off again. So we never find out, like, who sent it? What was it about? What was it, just wanting the whales? What was it? So... yeah, but I don't think I want that explained because I like that bit of mystery.
I'll be honest, they did a sequel novel to it. I seem to be turning into the king of expanded media on this podcast. But it was by Margaret Wanda Bonanno, and it's called Probe.
That's not a real name.
I'm only telling you. I'm only telling you what it is. And it's a really good book, actually. It takes place a few weeks after the events of the movie. And it kind of reveals where the probe came from, but it doesn't kind of shove it in your face, so it is still ambiguous by the end of it. And it's quite a well-done novel.
Ah, fair enough. That's cool. And my last thing about the writing, then, obviously we have to talk briefly about the scenes at the end. And so what did you guys think of the sort of the disciplinary proceedings, which are basically all thrown out except Kirk is demoted to exactly where he wants to be, to captain, and given the Enterprise A? Yeah, I thought it was a pretty cool little surprise ending, and it's kind of nice that even though they're being sentenced, everyone sort of stops and applauds.
Yeah, I love the movie, but those scenes at the end really bring a lump to my throat, and they shouldn't.
Yes.
Because they're not as emotional as, you know, obviously scenes from earlier in the trilogy, but you're so invested in this group of people. You can't help but punch the air when they get off.
Yeah, I completely agree. And even like little nice character moments, like, you know, Captain Spock, you're not on trial. I stand with my shipmates. You know, it's a nice moment. And especially the bit that I love that gets me choked up just from being a fan of knowing like the original series and the characters is Sarek saying to Spock, you know, as I recall, I opposed your enlisting in Starfleet. It's possible that I misjudged that, and your associates are people of great character. I say, oh man, coming from a Vulcan, that's practically like a love fest, you know?
Yeah.
And I mentioned already, you know, tell mother I feel fine, and yeah, getting the Enterprise A. And finally, ending the film with those fantastic, and again, DK, I know you'll appreciate this, those lovely 1980s and 90s sitcom style credits you have been watching in alphabetical order.
Yes. Yeah. I think I have the picture of Jane Weedley once more.
Exactly. Oh, well. So, yeah, I don't know. Do you guys have any other thoughts on the writing before we jump to the next section and I pass to DK?
Nope.
No, I think it's really well done. But, I mean, going into this, I'm going to bring it into the acting. And I don't think the script would have worked half as good had the performance not been as good, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, 100% for sure. Well, that is the next section. So if you want to jump straight into the acting, then yeah, take it away. You want to lead the conversation. So
yeah,
it's me talking the whole time.
I just the one couple of actors that don't stand out for me, ironically enough, is going back to what you're on about, the two garbage men. I can't get my head around those. They're a bit too sitcom for me, but the delivery. But everybody else, I don't think there's a, especially from the crew, there is not a bad performance in this movie. And I think it's the performances that sell this, without shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have any other sort of specifics or anything you want to get into?
No, not really. Just the fact that so much of it, you know, I mean, obviously there is a script there, but some of the best scenes were ad-libbed. And I just think it's a testament. You know, a lot of people don't rate, it's blasphemy to us, but a lot of people don't rate people like Bill Shatner and Leonard Nimoy as fantastic actors in the grand scheme of things. But when you look at him in this movie, I defy any actor to put in as good a performance as these guys did.
I will say there's one moment, and I know it's brief, but there's a moment where Shatner's acting really does veer into the ridiculous. When, you know what I'm going to say probably, when he's watching Spock in the tank and he has to look exasperated and he does the most over-the-top hand on the face, like, oh no, oh wow, oh, comedy gesturing, and I'm like,
yeah,
Shatner, what are you doing, man? Yeah, I could have lived without that, but that was the only bit that he goes on full-on sort of Shatner on it.
I don't know, the whole, you know, haven't you got any goddamn feelings about that? That comes across as a bit Rent the Ghost, but like the hand over the face in the aquarium, I can, with the predicament that they're in, I can buy that with the situation.
I'd like the moment you just referred to where he's like, yeah, you're talking about the end of life on Earth. You're half human. Don't you have any damn feelings about that? I like that scene. I think that's actually well acted, personally.
Well, I don't know. It's a bit, I don't know. It tests the boundaries, I think.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. Well, I've got a few little things I wanted to bring up. So I wanted to say Mark Leonard as Sarek, I think, for considering how barely he appears in the film, I think knocks it out of the park in his two scenes. You were saying like the emotional response you have, and the moment when he comes in and basically, you know, verbally slaps down the Klingon ambassador at the start of the movie, which has nothing to do with the main plot, but it's one of my favorite bits, the way he's like, Oh, no, I think you'll find you guys, you know, you started it. You were the ones that fired. Oh, we were perfectly justified. You were justified in murder. He's like, oh, he's not taking any of this guy's crap, is he? So, And yeah, I mentioned the bit at the end with Nimoy, which is great. I mentioned Jane Wyatt being great in her scene with him at the start. And this is, again, apropos of nothing specific to this movie, but I do like that we get Brock Peters, who would later play Joseph Sisko, appearing for the first time as Admiral Cartwright, who doesn't really get a lot to do, but it's kind of nice that they set that character up so that when Star Trek VI comes around, spoiler alert, it's quite a shock when he's one of the sort of guys that are, you know, saboteurs that are trying to sabotage the peace conferences between the Klingons.
I do like the irony in that, and as well as an actor, he was a vigorous civil rights activist, and then they make him one of the most racist people in Star Trek VI for hating all Klingons.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, it's dangerous territory, but I think it's because you establish it as a character that you've kind of rooted for in this movie. I think it does make it hit you a bit harder as opposed to you.
Yeah, oh, I'm so glad that they didn't go with Sarek as Sarek as well for. Valerius,
yeah, probably, yeah.
I mean, as much of a shock as Cartwright was, I think having Savick in Valerius' role would have been a step too far.
Yeah, probably. We're not reviewing Star Trek VI, though. We will probably one day, not right now. So yeah, talking about the acting, then we haven't really talked about the main kind of guest star for this movie, Catherine Hicks as Gillian. So yeah, what were your thoughts on that?
I think she's good. Again. She has a tendency occasionally to look a bit too exasperated a lot of the time, but I've not really known her for anything other than this, and I think later on she did Child's Play. I've not really seen in much else, so I can't say what her performance is in relation to her other roles, but I liked her. I think she's Gillian's an extremely likeable character. And I think I believe Nimoy hired her because when she came in for auditions, she had a good working chemistry with Shatner.
Fair enough. That makes sense. This is where I'm going to drop in another note from Adrienne, who just says that when she first saw the movie, she remembered being a bit annoyed with the way that Catherine Hicks played Gillian. But now she completely identifies with her and she just says, age. Yep. I think we're all at that point now. Well, we're getting there now where we're like, you know what? That level of exasperation is just every day.
I'm past that. I'm in the McCoy stage.
I've always been in the McCoy stage, my man.
Yeah, is there anybody that stood out to you, Stephen, as the, you know, being one of the best in the movie?
I mean, I've certainly got my favourites in there. I was going to just make a comment about where she obviously slaps her boss when she found out the wheels have gone. And, you know, good job she's got in the future. She's just lost her job.
Yeah, that was a bit of the current Twitter moment, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It's like, you know, expecting her to next it just go in and go, oh, I'm really sorry. But then she's like, I'm with her. I can go to the future and be really important because I'm the only person.
Wouldn't she be out of a job anyway since her job was basically looking after the two whales that they got rid of?
She's an expert in that, but, you know.
It is a kind of work of fantasy, though, to just go in and twat your boss.
Awesome. As well, you mentioned the hospital earlier. So the fact that they actually cure Chekhov and the doctors don't make any comment about the fact that they're stealing the patient. Who is in fact no longer a patient because he's fine. You could not see from the door that it actually, you know, regained consciousness and was talking.
Yeah. And that's never occurred to me, to be honest.
I certainly liked from the start, not being a particularly massive original series fan, was just the fact you get to see Vulcan.
Yes. Yeah, it looks really good.
Movie and things like that, and they're all wearing the traditional Vulcan gear and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. You did catch a glimpse of it in the motion picture, but this is the first time, I think, where it's like really, you know, you see the desert vistas and stuff quite clearly. And as you said, I think you do see the priestess at the end of 3 as well when she's returning Spock's Catra from McCoy. Yeah, cool. Fair enough. That's all I had about the acting. So. Do you guys, are you happy to move on to the little bits I have about directing of the movie? So the first note I have, and again, apologies, I know this is churlish, and I know, DK, you're going to throw the Mystery Science Theater Just Relax gif in my face. how during the trial where the Klingon ambassador guy is showing the footage of what Kirk did, how exactly was there a camera in space to film the destruction of the Enterprise perfectly from the outside? See,
I like that they called out attention to that, where Gillian gives them the coordinates in the Bird of Prey, and he says, put it on screen, and she says, how can you do that? And I think that just pretty much sums up everybody's feelings when watching these kind of things.
It just seems so weird. Like, who's filming the destruction of the Enterprise? Where are they getting it from, you know?
Yeah.
I know it's obviously just footage from the movie, but it's like, come on, guys. Really? And it's so well edited. It cuts from the inside to the outside, like, just as the Klingon discovers the sabotage and stuff. It's like, nah, come on, guys. A little bit of believability.
Maybe that's why Sarek turned up. He wanted to defend his son's directing.
Mr. Ambassador, this was a beautifully staged sequence. I really liked, this is a very, sort of, again, weird directing note, but I liked how kind of cool and futuristic San Francisco looked. And again, I know we've seen it in the motion picture, but I think just the little bits of like future cars and stuff flying by. And I will say a lot of the graphics and stuff in terms of the computer screens and crap like that, they're always the thing that date these movies, but my word, they look very 1980s, don't they?
They do, but I can still kind of deal with them, if you know what I mean. They're not off-putting. It's not like, say, if you put, when you put on something these days, like Lawnmower Man, and you think, Jesus Christ, but this is all right, you know?
Yeah, I can't quite get it. I mean, I know it's fair enough, because obviously in the original series, everything looked like it was from the 60s. So, you know, fair enough. But yeah, it's so... Like, come on, is this the highest level of computer they've got when they're like, show me the nearest starbase, and they go to like the 3D, whatever, sort of telemetry image, and it's just like watching war games or something. It's just like, guys,
oh, what's this? I did like all the screens where it kept cutting to, you know, reports from different ships and stuff like that in the background. I really like that. And again, going back, I did like the fact that Jane Wheedling was in there.
Yeah, exactly. And again, we've mentioned it in a previous episode, but it was nice to see the old mushroom space dock again. And and it was cool.
So
when they went past it and all the power went off, it was a really well done effect, I thought, as well. And possibly my favorite effect in the film, just for like sheer, again, how the F did they do it? It looks amazing. Is when the probe starts like sucking up those seas, basically, and the water goes like upright and starts flowing up towards it. I'm like, that is impressive, you know? I thought so, anyway. Let's see. I love that the headquarter scenes, you just get a real sense of the chaos of everything like breaking, and they're wiping water off the screens and running around, and there's one of the windows outside shatters, and the water starts coming in and stuff. It's like, all right,
apparently there was a scene filmed but excluded between Sarek and Christine Chapel.
Oh, well, that makes sense, because I know that Major Lee is credited and you do see her in the background, but she doesn't actually get a scene. So
no. Apparently, he asked her how are things going, and she says something like, "Oh, not good." But they have like a brief discussion prior to that. But again, it was deleted, so it would have been nice to have seen that. But I guess for non-fans, it wouldn't have made much sense in this grand scheme of things.
Yeah, although I mean, there is the scene where they say it looks like you're stranded here with us, Ambassador to Sarek, so you kind of get the sense of, oh dear, if they're going down, so is he.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
But even watching it now, I do think the directions and performances are good in that section, because as you know how it's going to end, but you still feel that sense of threat.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. No, I said that. That's absolutely the chaos that really comes through as well when you think like it's acting. They're not really in danger and stuff, but the sense of, you know, you do kind of brick it for them and you're like, oh, you better hurry up and get this sorted. So. Yeah, I appreciate all of that. And I do appreciate at the end as well. Again, it's such a stupid little thing, but I do appreciate that they arrive back like literally like the second after they'd left. So it replays the whole scene. And then right after the window shatters where it left it previously, they go, wait, what's that? Look over there. And it's the Bird of Prey coming back.
When I first saw that, it kind of blew my mind, because I'd never experienced anything like that before on TV or movie.
Yeah. Where the time travel makes logical sense. It's not like, well, the entire time you were away is time you have to account for when you go back. Because it's like, no, you're time traveling. You can go back a second later. There's no reason not to. So, yeah, I love that. This is, again, a little bit of a weird thing to make notice of, but I was looking out for kind of like directing flourishes and stuff, because as we've mentioned, it was Leonard Nimoy who directed this after doing Star Trek III. And there's a really beautiful scene, which is, it doesn't really have any purpose, but it's just artistically really nice when they first land after the time travel. And it's the camera sort of fades from the reeds outside of the like little swampy area where they've landed and fades into the image of them on the bridge, all kind of collapsed unconscious. And I was like, that's a really brilliant transition. You know what I mean? You could have easily just done nothing there, just cut straight to it or something, but I appreciated that.
See, when I first watched that, I thought the whole thing with the reeds, I thought that was actual reality. I thought obviously the morphing faces and the body dropping down to Earth was the dream sequence. But then it kind of faded into that reed section with the water.
No, I think that is reality. It's where they've landed, isn't it? That's the whole point. It's like it's the stillness after the chaos. That's why I appreciated it, kind of.
Yeah.
Anyway, I know what you're saying. You think it's still part of the dream sequence, but no, I think it's after they've landed, because it's like it's still out there, but some time has passed because they've been unconscious. And then I think Kirk wakes up first, doesn't he? And he's like, Sulu, wake up! Because, you know, it's Kirk, he's lazy. He can't look at a screen himself.
See, I'm not sure. I don't know if it is part of that dream sequence. That's how I've always read it anyway.
Fair enough. Well, we can always check again later. What do you think, audience? Chime in with us on this. Is that reality or is it still part of the time travel sequence? We'll do a poll maybe when this goes out and see.
What does throw me in that section where they wake up, though, is the fact that the background computers in the Klingon ship are using loading noises from the ZX Spectrum.
Well... I mean, you know, it's 1986. What else?
I know. I just imagine somebody listening to as an Spectrum and saying, "That's the sound we want." It's a very odd.
It could have been worse. At least it wasn't like Admiral the Klingon ship sounding an alert. Do 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 do.
The Atari Pac-Man noises that they kept using in Superman 3.
Exactly. Or just any that annoying noise that we all start to put up with whenever a modem was connecting to the internet. You start to just hear it go coo car. But I don't think Klingon exactly. I thought the Klingon graphics were pretty good though, because they did at least remember that they should have been Klingon, so you know that's what they looked like, isn't it? In the background of the things. So where am I again? There we are. So it all looked like that instead of looking like a starship. I'm really proud of making that sign. I just wanted to leave it up there again. Anyway, yeah, and again, that end scene, we could talk about it forever, but enough has been said about it, how glorious it is when they sweep under the Golden Gate Bridge for the landing. Right after they've chased the whaling ship off, and then they do that kind of landing and stuff. And yeah, I think it's a really fantastic, very breathtaking scene. And even though there's not a ton of action in the movie, what it does have, I think, is really good and works really well. That was the other thing I was going to say was, as I was talking about the kind of video of this having little behind the scenes stuff on, for some reason, I remember it having a full on explanation as to why it was better to watch these things in widescreen. Because like back in the day, you had to have the black bars on the top and bottom because TVs were still square and stuff. And the video was in widescreen. And I think to combat the fact that people used to always complain and be like, it's cut off half the image. Sort of had an entire thing where it explains, like, if you had the pan scan version, and it used the scene of Kirk, Spock, and Gillian in the car, how it would have to sort of, the camera would have to move left and right depending on who was speaking. But the way it was filmed and shown in cinemas, they were all in shot, all three of them. So again, I don't know if you can still find that on the internet, but it was kind of weirdly fascinating. So if you can, look it up. Yeah. Any other thoughts on like directing or, you know, the staging of scenes and things?
No, I just, I think Nimoy did a fantastic action sequence job when with the hospital chase. It does still get the blood pumping. Not so much, I don't think, where Chekhov's being chased, and you can tell it's an obvious, you know, stand-in for Chekhov in silhouette. But I think that hospital sequence is filmed brilliantly.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, again, it's worth noting that he pulls off the action sequences but also the comedy sequences, which are often harder. So like I've mentioned already, the kind of the plexicorp scene, the way that's played for the comedy and staged and everything, it's difficult to do that and not make it come across as over the top, you know?
And the fact that, you know, I mean, when he was directing Trek 3, obviously he wasn't in it as much.
Yeah.
But he's got more screen time than, you know, a lot of the people in this. And he's still directing to such a point that you think, this is really good. I mean, hats off to him for that.
Definitely. I think that's where the assistant director or second unit director comes in and deserves some praise. But I foolishly didn't look up who it was. But I'm sure they did a great job. So, DK, did you want to take us through anything you have on the sound and music?
Yeah, I'm going on their soundtrack now with regards to Leonard Rosenman. When I first heard the soundtrack, I really wasn't impressed. We had Goldsmith, which was memorable. We had James Horner, which was just bone-shakingly fantastic. And I remember being incredibly disappointed by Rosenman's score at first. But as time's gone on and I look back at it, you know, it works. It kind of works like for the tone that the movie's setting. You wouldn't be able to get away with something like James Horner for this.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't work. But as members of my family say, they cannot listen to the main theme without thinking it's a Christmas movie.
I made the note, the main theme I think has a certain sense of whimsy and the frolicking. Like the other ones, as you mentioned, are very bombastic, like this is a grand adventure and this is like we're off on an adventure. Which is, you know, it's fine, it fits the tone of the film perfectly, so why not?
it does. I mean back then when I first heard it, I was a moody teenager, so you know, I was all, oh, James Horner and what is this rubbish, but it fits perfectly. And I love the little motifs that he used every now and again, you know, when he harks back to the original series when they see the Enterprise A.
Yes, that's great.
Really does bring a lump to your throat.
Definitely. Because I've mentioned already, I'm making a point of trying to like look or listen out for soundtrack more, because it's not something I notice, and I get a lot of crap from certainly Will if all people for not noticing these things. And I did notice a few moments here, like when they kind of have to reveal that they're arrived in 1986 San Francisco, and then the music just cuts into the most funky 1980s kind of disco stuff you've ever heard to kind of really emphasize that's where they are. I was like, okay, I appreciate it. I get this. That's cool.
That's on the soundtrack. I've played that so many times.
I think, if I remember rightly, don't quote me on this though, that Kirk Thatcher may have written the song I Hate You.
He did.
I think, I don't remember if he wrote it or not, but I do know that when he comes back in Picard, he's listening to the song I Still Hate You, which I really appreciated as a joke that doesn't whack you over the head with that joke, but if you listen to the lyrics and hear that's what it's saying and know the context, I really found that oddly hilarious.
I love the design as well, the sound design when it comes to the communication from the probe.
I had that note as well. Yeah, the probe noise is fantastic.
Yeah. When it was originally shot, they had subtitles, so you could see what the probe was saying. But Nimoy wanted them removed because he thought having it ambiguous would add to the atmosphere, and I think he made the right call on that one.
Yeah, definitely. How would that have worked? What would the subtitles be? Like, hello, Wales, are you there?
Yeah, it was something like, you know, when the probe was above Earth and it's going, it was coming up along the bottom saying, where are you? And things like that.
I wouldn't have liked that. No, definitely. You may as well have the whale probe doing its Geordie. Why are you? Call back. Yeah. But no, speaking of the music, I did like that. Again, the Chekhov escape, I didn't think it was played for all that much kind of drama and tension, because the music's quite jaunty. So it kind of, again, it gives you the sense of like, he's fine. It's just a bit of an adventure. But the best moment for me, the best thing on the soundtrack, is when they're in the sea at the end. And it's the kind of great victorious moment music as they're all celebrating. And even though the Klingon Bird of Prey is slowly sinking into the sea, and they're all just like, ah, let's frolic in the water.
Yeah.
That's fair enough. So I don't really, that's all I have until we get to like favorite moments and conclusions and bits and pieces. But anything at all from you two, anything you want to talk about or bring up from the film?
I think we've pretty much covered everything I've got. So it's over to Stephen.
I was going to mention just how simple they actually hid the fact that Spock was Vulcan.
Oh, yeah, when he just, yeah, that's another acting thing. he makes the kind of a meal of the sort of just staring at him and then making a bandana out of his robe. And yeah. It's like, yeah, it's very much pretty cool. And it saves you having to have another incredibly racist rice picker accident moment.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, City on the Edge of Forever, man. That's your one moment I just don't appreciate on that. Anyway, but yeah, it is obvious, and yet, yeah, it works. I do think it's silly that nobody seems bothered. He's clearly in like a robe the entire time, or that he comes out from being submerged completely underwater and just dries off in about a minute and a half. Other than that,
Well, I mean, the robe thing, it's San Francisco.
True, people probably, you know, he was a monk or a Hare Krishna or something.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah, anything else, Stephen?
No, that's really it. No.
Awesome, that's cool. So we've talked, I think, more or less about all of the things, but again, just so many great scenes. It seems like we haven't talked enough about how good all of them are, but we will hopefully in the sort of favourite moments and stuff, because it deserves our respect. So let me just see if I have anything else. Oh yeah, just to finish off any notes that Adrienne had about bits and pieces, she does just say she finds it very interesting that in the recent Kelvin timeline movies, Carl Urban seems to sound exactly like this particular version of McCoy in the way he plays the scenes, to her brain at least. I can see what you mean by that. Yeah, definitely.
I can pick up on that, but I think it's because maybe this was a kind of gateway for a lot of people into the franchise. So this is how they actually see McCoy, not from the series itself. So I can kind of understand why they would do that.
Yeah, for sure. I also think it's one of the better versions because, like I said, it's still got the kind of lovable crotchetiness of McCoy, but without that kind of... There's times in the original series when it veers dangerously on racism, when he's all like, ah, you green-blooded, pointy-eared goblin, yeah. I'm like, dude... You know, it's like you don't need to be that vile just to be like to bust his chops, basically, which, as I said, does perfectly in this one. So, yeah, cool. So that was it for that. So then, shall we move on to our favorite character moment and line? Then we can do the audience interaction bit and then maybe jump in with conclusions.
Yeah,
okay. Sure. Awesome. We'll go to you first, Stephen, because we've been talking a lot and you haven't. So what's your favourite? Who's your favourite character in the movie? Sorry.
I mean, I was going to joke Will and Gracie, but...
George and Gracie, not Will and Gracie. Will and Gracie was an early 2000s sitcom.
That's a sitcom I want to watch.
Okay. Well, then I'll see you, Miles. Yeah. I think character for me, Bones.
Ah, okay, and why?
Just the one-liners, the puns throughout. And I do like the hospital scene. Willy boys who have done something. Here we go.
I think he does get a lot to do, though. But yeah, do you have, other than giving away your favourite line, do you have any specific moments we might not have mentioned from McCoy then?
Probably giving the woman the pill that cures a kidney.
Again, I mentioned this to DK. I do love, again, without hammering you over the head with it, it's a background thing, but it's hilarious that he gives her the pill. You don't know what's happening, and then like an entire scene happens, and in the scene on the way out, you just hear her in the background going, "That guy gave me a pill that grew a new kidney." So what? It's so weird, but yeah. Totally appreciate
it's a simple sort of thing, you know, like, oh my god, what is this, the Dark Ages, as they're talking about your cancer treatment and
stuff. Chemotherapy and stuff, he just thinks is ridiculous and barbaric, and even when the saving of Chekhov, when he's like, it's not, you know, the solution isn't drilling a hole in his head, you idiot. What about you then, DK, who's your favorite character in the movie?
This one were a tough one for me. I mean, as we said earlier, every single member of the crew shines in this. But I think I'm going to have to go with Spock. As I've said, not only did Nimoy pull double duties, but considering he had to deliver it, you know, really deadpan, coupled with the fact that a few of his scenes were ad-libbed, I think Nimoy's timing is just first rate. I think it comes through in you know, his performance as Spock. I think he absolutely steals it.
Yeah. Definitely. That's cool. Just bear with me because I'm trying to find. I don't know if Adrienne left me her favorite character, but maybe she did, and I've just deleted the thing. She didn't, but yeah, anyway. I'll give you my favorite character then. We are, as usual, on the same page, Stephen. We've obviously been friends for years, and it goes to jokes. My favorite character was also McCoy in this one, which I've said is because he is all of us in this situation, the way that he's like exasperated. He's having fun when he can, but he's just like over it. And I think that's what we would be like if we had to travel back to like the 80s and stuff. He's kind of like, ugh. And the way he kind of slaps down Spock at times, or even Scotty. Plus, like I said, he's Spock's guide back to humanity, the way that he's trying to teach him about that part instead of just the Vulcan stuff. So, yeah. Adrienne definitely hasn't left me her favorite character, but the fact that she makes a point of mentioning the Carl Urban stuff makes me think she probably would have said McCoy as well. So I'm just going to give it to him because why not? So it's 3-1, DK.
I'm magnanimous in that. I can accept that. He would have been my second.
Fair enough. That's cool. So, Stephen, what was your favorite moment in the film overall?
Can't it be Hello Computer? What was the joke? I work in IT. That seems completely natural to me. that's why I ask both the people who think that's exactly how a computer works.
Does anybody ever pick up the mouse and try to talk into it?
The regular pointing at the screen or using the mouse on the screen physically.
The way he doesn't know what a mouse is hilarious. Like seeing a computer and expecting a voice response is like, it's the 80s. But then when the guy goes, just use the mouse, and he picks it up and uses it like a microphone to go, ah, okay, hello, computer. It's so stupid, but so great.
And then he's absolutely excellent at typing.
Yeah, typing like your dad trying to type something in general, you know, like
you one thing. He was you're spot on, like touch typing sort of thing. Almost like one finger at a time. But the fact he did it so well, having not used that before.
Whatever he's doing on the keyboard to try and get that stuff to do it on the screen bears no resemblance whatsoever. Really a director who doesn't know technology, who's just like, just make it look like you're hitting every key as quickly as you can. I don't know. Ah, yes. 1980s hacking, where we just hit the keyboard in a number of times, and suddenly the screen has anything we want to have happen. Great scene, though, it is. How do we know he didn't invent the thing? You know, if we give him the formula, we're changing time.
Loose and fast with time throughout the movie. You mentioned glasses and things like that as well.
You say that, but apparently there's a deleted scene. I don't know if it was filmed, where they do specify that turns out that guy did invent transparent aluminium. So they were literally doing what they would have had to keep the paradox or the grandfather paradox thing going. So it's like, do we appreciate it more that they didn't do that for the humor, or was that like, phew, you know, kind of thing? Yeah. I don't think we need it, but yeah. Awesome. Such a good scene. I'm with you on that. What about you, DK?
There's quite a few to choose from a comedic point of view, but I think I'm going to have to go with the one that hit me the most emotionally, which was my friends, we've come home, when they first went to the Enterprise A.
Yeah, definitely. I do love that as well. That scene's great. Kind of a shame that I always get bugged by Star Trek V, the way that it just completely peas on that ending, when it's like, oh, let's see what we what it's got, he said. And we saw, didn't he? Bucket of bolts just fell apart. And I'm like, oh, come on.
Yeah,
it's kind of a shame you've ruined that nice ending, you know.
It does kind of undercut it, but yeah, for what it is, I do love that.
Yeah, I also appreciate that Sulu wants the Excelsior as well, because we know he ends up getting it. So yeah. That's a nice.
Hal Bennett wanted him to end up on the Excelsior, but he was outvoted.
Ah. Well, fair enough. He gets to captain it anyway later on. Yeah. So. I think he was going to be captaining it from, like, as you said, 2 or 3, but. The movie, I mean, but yeah, anyway. So Adrienne did actually send her favorite scene. She says that hers is the bird of prey flying right over the whaling ship when the crew desperately tries to turn the boat around. And she's just written in big capitals, ha ha ha, idiots. All right, chill. So yeah, I could name so many scenes. We've probably talked about most of them. And if you've seen the movie, you'll know yourself it's an embarrassment of riches. But I had to pick a favorite, and I still kind of cheated because I would say I'm going to pick both of the scenes with Sarek from the start and end of the movie. So those, I think, are my two favorites. Which again, I've talked about slapping down the Klingon and then the nice moment with Spock. Then the last thing then here is, what is your favorite line in the movie, Stephen? And again, there's lots to pick.
Unfortunately, I have to probably go back to the other computer. So simple. For me, it's just like, yeah.
you should have picked... We haven't mentioned it yet, but you should have picked a keyboard. How quaint.
I think the other one would probably be the, my God, what is this, the Dark Ages?
Definitely. That's cool. What about you then, DK?
Well, it's not so much the line, but we've already talked about this, at the recording. Not so much the line, but the way it's delivered, which is McCoy's reaction to find that he's got to accompany Scotty and Sulu to find a way to house the whales, and he just says, oh, joy.
Yeah, it's a little moment, but yeah, that's fair enough. Adrienne's favourite line, and I think this kind of speaks to a lot of other moments, the actual line she's put is, they are not the hell your whales. But I think there's so many moments that like that where Spock kind of mucks up the placement of a swear word or just chucks it in very blasé that I think that's going to speak for all of them. I wrestled with this because, like I said, I've listed a load of moments that I thought were great, but in the end I have to go with the obvious sort of line that became iconic, which I always love, which is, don't tell me you're from outer space. No, I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space. Which I just love. I love that line. Fair enough. So, yeah. Anything else then before I jump into the audience's responses?
No.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Incoming transmission.
In that case, we did put out onto social media, do you think Voyage Home's a hit or a miss? What are your thoughts on the movie? We had responses from Mastodon, which is where you're probably going to be finding us more from now on. We are probably going to be shutting down the Twitter pages, so do keep an eye out for the new links and things in the description. But for now, I did get some feedback from Twitter, which we'll go into as well. But we'll start from the Mastodon page that I put out the response, because I've got a few more there. So again, Sacred Chalice of Rick's, that's Rick Everson, who joined us on the very first episode, says, it's a massive hit. It's an 80s movie with Star Trek characters, brilliant stuff, and a nice fun adventure to tie off the trilogy that had been pretty serious up to this point. To this day, I still get tense as they are flying in to get to George and Gracie before the whalers do. So yeah, I think that kind of relates to what Adrienne was saying about her favorite moment as well. At OG Trekker at Trekkies.social says, I loved it. It's the best of the three, in my opinion. At O Alex Simmons Social Club.nyc says, as long as we're calling it the right title, and he's not going to be friends with us because he's put a little meme that just says it's called The Voyage Home, not the one with the whales. Have fun, guys. Just go with it. If you can't beat them, join them. That's what I've just realized. let's see. At Welshmaltz at Mastodon.online says, anyone who doesn't like this has definitely did too much LDS. at Leopardboy at Netmonkey.xyz just says, definitely a hit. I was 9 or 10 when I first saw it, and I liked it because I liked all the Star Trek films at that point in my life. But as I've gotten older, I've come to really appreciate it. It's a great comedy, I think. Yeah, definitely. Let's see, what else? At Alex Medina Bright at nerdculture.de says, hit, it's my favorite of the original series movies. At Punk on Bus 1701 at 10forward.social, great handle.
Says, that is fantastic.
I know, right? Definitely a hit. I can genuinely say that I've never spoken to even one Trekkie that thinks it's a bad movie. I don't think I have either, so yeah, fair enough. right. And then, so yeah, going over to Twitter then, whilst we still have it. Byron Bailey just says big hit and then left a little Vulcan salute emoji. By Riker's Beard says hit, huge hit, one of the best Trek films of any era, might have brought more new fans in than any other. Phasers are fun, brackets Phil, says hit for sure. Clockwork Demon says that's not a legitimate question. Yeah, and that's it. That's all of the feedback that we had from the various social medias on this. So, yeah, without any further ado, we're going to jump into our conclusions and our scores out of five.
A spark analysis.
What about my performance?
I'm not a drama critic.
I may as well start with Adrienne's because it's very short, so, you know, why not? So, her conclusion is just the humour is wonderful. And that's it. That's all she gave me to go with. And then she said that she would score it 4 out of 5. So 4 stars out of 5. So that was her score for this. Stephen, we'll go to you next. Do you want to give your conclusion and score?
Score's going to be tough. Conclusion, yeah, really enjoyable. I'm trying to think where it came in the top 10, actually, when we did that. Do you recall?
Oh, I can't remember now. And I just put it out the other day.
I think it came in the top 5.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly. Not my favourite, but certainly you're one of the better movies out of the bunch, really. Trying to think how I put it before Khan or not. No, I think Khan came third. I think it was third for me. But yeah, really enjoyable, and yeah, it was a nice change of pace, as you just mentioned, really, considering the previous ones were quite dark with a lot of death and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I'm going to go with 3.5.
Oh, that's okay. It's a little lower than I thought, but yeah, any reason why you wouldn't go any higher then?
Not particularly. I just didn't feel like you were in a 4.
That's cool. If it doesn't hit you in that way, it doesn't hit you. That makes sense.
Well, it's my third out of the three. You know, I think I've mentioned before, Star Trek 6 is my favourite, Wrath of Khan, and then, you know, my third would probably Star Trek 4. So
that's fair enough. I found the top 10 and Star Trek 4 actually came fourth overall when we ranked them. It goes Wrath of Khan, Undiscovered Country, First Contact, then Voyage Home, then inexplicably Star Trek 09 coming in fifth. What were you guys drinking?
Cider.
Anyway, right, DK, do you want to give us your conclusion and score then?
Yeah, I've got a genre crush enjoy that manages to take the third part in a trilogy and not only make it accessible to those that haven't been party to the last two, but make it a fun gateway into the franchise itself. It takes the very best of Trek, high sci-fi concepts, moral quandaries and human relationships, and wraps them up in a time travel fish out of water comedy that not only satisfies the most avid of Trekkers, but appeals to non-fans too. The performances are pitch perfect, and despite their self-deprecating aspects, it never undermines the characters themselves. It's not just a group of people, it's a family, and nowhere is this more apparent than in this. It fits so much into its 2-hour runtime, and yet it's so well done that for the most part, you don't even notice with it going by in a flash. At the end, you're just left with a warm glow in your heart and a smile on your face. It's a cinematic Star Trek miracle, and for that alone, The Voyage Home deserves all the praise it gets and more, and I've given it 4.5.
Okay, cool. That's fair enough. I will say this time around was the only time that I was paying attention just to see how it was kind of structured, and it was kind of shocking to me that they don't arrive back in the 1980s until about 45 minutes into the movie. Like, there's a lot of time devoted to the setup, which I don't think feels like that it's dragging its heels before it gets to the point. You're saying that for sure. So my conclusion then, sorry if it's a bit long, I just thought it's a movie that could only work as the fourth in the franchise, and after so much time with these characters and in this world, it uses that familiarity to make a film that is at its core a character piece for almost a whole ensemble, poor Sulu, allowing for a sense of humour which doesn't take anything away and actually greatly benefits the characters, actors and the film. It balances a plot that could seem preachy using the sincerity that's been well established in this fictional world and continues to be used perfectly here. I won't lie, the lack for most of the film of recognisable Starfleet future spaceship battles and the things that I personally gravitate towards does lose it a bit of shine in my eyes. But for what it is, I have to commend the ingenious plotting, the deftly handled tone, the effortless looking great acting and direction. It's also paced perfectly, something I just noticed on this rewatch, with the perfect time dedicated to setup, the missions that make the core plot in 1986 and the denouement. It has probably the most and best quotable lines in the franchise, and with its social message and ultimate optimism, it might be the most Trek-like. I enjoyed every minute, and not for the first time. Plus, it looks incredible. And I also gave it 4.5 out of 5.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good man.
Working out the average on that then by adding all of those scores together and sharing it by 4, because we are including Adrienne's, that gives Star Trek IV The Voyage Home a final score of 4.125. But we'll call it 4.12 out of 5 for Star Trek IV The Voyage Home, which I think is going to place it pretty high up on the leaderboard. Not top by any means, but pretty high on the old time travel leaderboard.
It actually puts it in the bottom half.
Wow, really?
Ooh. Yeah.
We must have been reviewing some very highly praised and regarded episodes then, in that case. But, wow, okay. 4.12 in the bottom half. We have to start watching some crap for this next series.
Do you want me to go through the leaderboard, seeing as it's the last one?
Yeah, yeah. Can do, yeah.
Okay, with the bottom entry, to no one's surprise, being Assignment Earth from the original series, which scored
in the bin. Sorry, Rick. Yeah.
Just above that was, I think, a big disappointment for both me and you after so much time, Mike, and that was Little Green Men from Deep Space Nine at 3.3.
Sorry, Vian.
Yeah. Above that, which is quite a surprise considering that we both liked it, is myself and Will, was Future Tense from Enterprise at 3.75.
I wasn't on that one, so yeah, I can't really be judged for that.
Above that is I think it's yet to be broadcast, but by the time this comes out, obviously it will be, and that's the animated series is Yesteryear at 4.
Oh wow, I thought that would have been higher, but yeah, okay. I think I brought the average down on that, though, because I made it 3.5 out of 5. I pulled a Stephen on that one.
I thought he will be disappointed.
Yeah, exactly.
If he was alive.
Oh, gosh. Don't do that.
Oh, my God. What are you doing?
I don't feel well.
And the next one on the list, it's actually today's episode, Star Trek IV The Voyage Home, with 4.12, did you say?
4.12 out of 5. Well, yeah. I guess 4.13 if you were rounding it up, arguably, but that's not going to make much difference, is it?
No. The next one on the list is Time's Arrow from Next Generation, which comes in with 4.2.
Is this? That's not really the bottom half. This is more like the middle area here, isn't it, when you think?
No, I just divide it into two halves. We're in the top 5 now.
What did you say Time's Arrow got, sorry?
Time's Arrow is 4.2.
Ah, okay, I thought you said 4.12. I was going to say same as Voyager, but yeah, 4.2.
No, 4.2.
You weren't on that one, so you can't be blamed for that either.
No. Next one is Trials and Tribulations, Deep Space Nine, which comes in at 4.25.
Well, and again, I wasn't on that one, so you've only got you and Runa to blame for that. Although that does deserve a high placement, to be fair. That is a great episode.
Yeah. The next one, we've got City on the Edge of Forever from original series at 4.3.
Criminal that it's not number one. You guys are just have no taste, you and Will.
Oh, stop it. You know I love it. it's just what it averages out. I honestly thought Voyage Home would have got higher.
Same. I blame Stephen for that, though. 3.5.
The number 2 spot is Time Amok from Prodigy at 4.5.
Wow. Wow, number 2. Yikes. Okay, cool.
Considering that's the first Prodigy episode we've reviewed, that is a very good score.
That's incredible, yeah.
Yeah, number 1, which I honestly thought today was going to dislodge it, but no, it's been unbeatable, is Deep Space Nine's The Visitor with 4.7.
Wow. I thought I was being like really harsh to that because I think I only gave it 4 and you and Dom, I think, both went 5. So that's why that's coming out top, which I don't think a lot of people aren't going to disagree with. It's a well-known episode. I don't think it's as great as you guys do at times. And I know certain people like Vian and such also agree with me. It's not necessarily the 5-star masterpiece, but it won the season. So congratulations, The Visitor and DS9 for being officially, apparently, the best time travel episode. At least of the, 11 that we've looked at? 10, sorry.
Yeah, we would have, I'll reiterate that we would have looked at more had the guest situation not imploded.
Yeah, we will definitely We will definitely do a follow-up kind of second time travel related one, because I'm also aware that the way things panned out, we way overly favoured DS9 and yet didn't really do anything from Voyager. Which
we've not done any Voyager, nothing from Discovery. So, yeah.
Again, we did have plans, because at one point we were going to look at Future's End. We were going to look at Terra Firma from Discovery. We're going to look at Assimilation from Star Trek Picard. But these plans all just fell through, so... maybe look out for that if we do another follow-up series, which hopefully we will. But that won't be the next series, because we already have that locked in. And we can officially announce here that we will be returning next year. We can't say exactly when, but it'll probably be a few months. Don't worry, there'll still probably be content coming out at least once a month in the meantime. But when we do return for Series 4, the theme of that series, DK, do you want to reveal it?
It's Klingons.
It's the Klingons, everyone's favorite species. So,
Michael get another chance to use his graphics.
Oh, I've already got the hit or miss graphic ready for the with the Klingon sort of logo and everything. So yeah, awesome. Do join us for that. And if you do want to be a guest, again, by all means, get in touch with us. We are happy to try and accommodate, particularly if there is a Klingon related episode that you want to look at. Just let us know. We can always try to fit that in as well. I do have a list of about 11 that I want to look at, but I'm more than happy to change that if you specifically want to look at one that's not on the list. And again, there's plenty to choose from, because those pesky Klingons get around. So, yeah. And maybe, you know, if you're curious, maybe get chatting. What are some of the best and your favorite Klingon episodes? And we can sort of see that feedback. So that's great. And in the meantime, then, all that remains is to say thanks to Adrienne for appearing via in absentis, shall we say, and leaving us a few notes and contributing to the final score. Sorry again that you couldn't be here with us, Adrienne. You had to work, but... again, we will definitely have you on next series, because we know it's not your fault. And on a slightly brighter note, welcome again. And thanks again, Stephen, for coming and chatting all things Voyage Home, even if you did give it a criminally low score.
Oof, maybe you guys are just giving them high scores. I don't know. I enjoyed it. I do not regret my scores, though. I had to Google The Visitor to see exactly what episode it was, because it was...
Wow, really?
I can see. I understand why you've given it a high score, but you mentioned some ones I would have definitely put higher in the rankings.
Oh, I would have said the same personally. And I had this discussion when I was when Vian was on reviewing Little Green Men. We said like we like it, but certainly I don't think it's the 5-star masterpiece that DK and Dom thought it was. But again, Dom had personal reasons, I guess, for that as well. So that's absolutely fair enough. And it is very good. Don't get me wrong, but yeah, it's not even my favorite DS9. It's not even in my top 5 DS9. I don't think episodes, but you know, time will tell, I guess. So yeah, thanks again, Stephen, for joining us for this, and hopefully you will join us again. Do you have any particular Klingon related things you wanted us to look at?
I think we've got the certain reference about blood wine that will have to be mentioned.
You want to look at the DS9 episode Apocalypse Rising, don't you?
Oh, of course not. No.
I don't know how that episode became such like a running joke between us, like for decades now.
Yeah. It's so weird. Look at between me and the blood wine. But I mean, you've got a Weird Warrior.
Yeah, We're the Warriors definitely an option. Yeah. We don't want to go too heavily just on DS9, though, because, again, we did that this series. So, yeah, if anybody has any from the other series, then that might be worth letting us know. It's not difficult for the original series, because there's, three or four Klingon episodes? So not going to be tough to choose from those. And, what about you, DK? Do you have anything in mind?
I'm going with Day of the Dove.
Oh, that was one I definitely want to do, so that'll be happening. Awesome. Well, so do join us for that. And in the meantime, like I said, do follow us over on our sister podcast, or possibly on this podcast if you're hearing it on the Silver Screen channel. We review movies over there all of the time and give various top 10 lists and stuff. And if you're listening to this, we will be about to embark on our December busy period. We're going to do an episode every week, so you can tune in to see not only this review but also reviews of Avatar, a top 10 Disney movies episode, and a Christmas special review of Gremlins with a special treat. And again, both podcasts will be active starting next year, where we may even have a surprise to announce. But do join us for we're doing, DK, do you want to give the details on this? We're doing a kind of end of year wrap up live special. Yeah. Over on the screen as well.
in the tradition of Charlie Brooker's Screen Wipe, or, you know, Clive James's End of the Year Review, if you're that old, or, you know, film 80, whatever it is, we are going to try and have a Christmas / New Year special. It's going to be a bit of a, what would you say, a step out of our normal comfort zone. We're actually going to do it live stream. So it's going to be me, Mike, Will, a bevy of guests. We're all probably going to be tanked up and making a fool of ourselves. So be sure to join in. If nothing else, it'll be entertaining for a it'll be all right on the night kind of vibe.
And what date and time can people expect to tune into that then?
We're looking at the 29th of December, I believe. Have we actually come up with an exact time as yet? Or are we going with the usual about 7 GMT?
We haven't really said, but yeah, I would assume probably 6 or 7 GMT and maybe go for a few hours, hopefully, if we get enough guests. But we are hopefully going to invite everyone that's been a guest on both podcasts to at least jump in, contribute, you know, send us their thoughts, their favourite and least favourite films, TV, music, etc. of the year, make a little video if they fancy it. So, yeah. So, Stephen, that's your task before that comes out, if you don't mind. What's that?
Noted, yes.
Yes, cool. Yeah, this is me informing you. So, yeah, do tune in for that. And, yeah, in the meantime, just remember that even though this series is over for the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast, we remain Starfleet. Live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper.
You have been listening to the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Created, produced, and edited by Michael Wilson. Additional material produced by DK. Music by Timeless Journey. More information can be found at soundcloud.com/timelessjourney. The Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast is based on an idea by Michael Wilson and Will Templar. Follow the podcast on Twitter at HomeTrek, on Instagram at Home Star Trek Podcast, or look for the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast under Facebook groups. Links to all our social media accounts and more are in this episode's description. This podcast is available on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Just look for Silver Screen Hit or Miss Star Trek. This has been a Mike's Podcast production, copyright 2022. Thank you for listening.